Hey, podcasters, welcome to another edition of Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. I'm your host, Tim Esterdahl, on today's show, and it's going to be a great show. I know I say that all the time. This time it's different. It's going to be really good. We're going to have some truck news. We're going to talk about a million mile Tundra, and we're going to talk about a Jeep Wrangler Rubicon I've been driving around all week. So let's start off with some basic truck news that's been out there. We've talked about this for a couple weeks now. The 2019 Chevy Silverado was spy-shotted yet again. It's fully camouflaged. You can't hardly see anything besides a bunch of camouflage-looking weird truck driving around. I mean, that's really what it looks like. Theories are abound on this Silverado. We have the sense it'll be unveiled in Detroit of next year at the North American International Auto Show. Theories are widely available about diesel engines, about aluminum body, about powertrains and design and what new features it'll have. My two cents on this is it's going to be a lot less than what the rumors think it's going to be. It'll have a new redesigned front. It'll have a new redesigned maybe cabin. Cabin will probably be a little more redesigned. They'll try to change up the IP instrument panel on a little bit. It's going to still have a ton of technology features. They have loaded this truck up with a slew of technology features. I'm not sure what else I can add besides Teen Driver or one of their new Teen Driver systems, which I don't know if it makes any sense on a pickup, but okay. I think it will have a diesel. Chevy and GMC have been offering diesels quite a bit on the Acadia, on the Terrain, on the Equinox. They're just every time they turn around, they have a new SUV with a diesel option. So it seems like they are all company-wide bought into a diesel engine. So I would theorize they have a diesel engine. I would theorize it won't have aluminum. It's kind of a sexy thing to say that it's going to have aluminum. I don't see it. I think it'll have a lot more high-strength steel. The new high-strength steel is lighter than the old steel, and so they're still going to get some weight savings, and I'm just not foreseeing that. I think that's too much cost and too much involved in getting that done. I think it's going to be steel. It's going to have a diesel. It's going to have weight savings with high-strength steel without it throughout it. I just don't see any other changes. Also spotted new this week is the 2018 Toyota Tundra prototype. It has a new front grille on it. There's some photos out there. Basically, it's got a bunch of camouflage over the front of it. Again, another vehicle you can't see a whole lot about, a whole lot of changes with currently because it's still in development. I'm going to theorize that the truck would be unveiled at the Chicago Auto Show next year, which makes sense in their timeline of how they do things. I'm just not seeing a lot with this one either. I'd like to see a lot with it, but to be frankly, I've been disappointed in some of the offerings that they've done and updates they've done to it. They're just not focused on the powertrain improvements, it doesn't sound like. I'd like to see them, more 8-speed transmission, maybe from Lexus would make some sense. Get some of that highway fuel economy numbers up. I'd like to see the 5.7 liter get the same dual port injection system that the Tacoma has. It could have the Axton cycle. You could do the port and the if you didn't have the word for it, but there's two types of injection system on that engine to allow fuel delivery to happen just right at combustion. And so there could be some small improvements like they did with the Tacoma that could pay off with some fuel economy benefits. I foresee maybe some more high strength steel, which is what Chevy's doing, and Toyota could do it as well without spending a lot of money on development. I don't think the cabin's going to change a whole lot. I don't foresee that. I think they keep the same rear end, big cabin in the Crew Max. I think the seats will still fold up instead of slide and recline, although note to Mike Swears, I'm still upset about that. And he knows it. So I will say this. If the seats are going to fold up, if you're going to fold the back bottom of the seat up, put some damn storage hooks up there. Let's hang some bags off it or give me some unique storage capability. I'd also love a flat load floor back there. I've driven a couple Fords now, and that is fantastic. I've hopped in the back end and had to, get to crawl across or get some kids' toys out or whatever, and a flat load floor back there is really convenient instead of having the humps for the middle of the transmission. And that's just an engineering thing. Although I did notice that the truck does get taller, so there's going to be some pro and con there. It's basically you gotta lift up the cab a little bit, or you gotta drop transmission down a little bit, or you gotta change up the way it's built to be able to have that happen. So a little pro and con, but it is a nice feature. And the 2017 model, which one are we gonna do? So Truck Trend says it's 2018 model. I'm gonna say it's a 2019 Tundra. So I'm gonna make that statement right now. The 2018 model, and the reason I bring that up is it has all the new Toyota safety equipment. And speaking of that, it has the active emergency braking. And if you check the show, was it last week or our website, you'll notice I wrote a whole article for Ford-Trucks.com about grille guards and bull bars. I call them bull bars. People call them grille guards. I was apparently wrong. It's okay. Bull bars and grille guards, both of those metal apparatuses that bolt to the front of the pickup, don't work with these advanced safety technologies because the radar and the sonar these safety technologies use interferes with the bars. There's been some talk I learned later at SEMA, which is the Specialty Equipment Manufacturers Association, had a working day conference a couple years ago at the show, and they talked about how to make bull bars and grille guards work with advanced safety technology. I missed that event. I didn't see it. I don't know what they're talking about. I hope that there's workarounds for that. I'm just not seeing it with the way the safety systems are built. They are a bunch of sonar and radar along the front of the truck. Typically, most manufacturers put it behind the badge and then on the bumper. If you see these new trucks, if you ever been to a new truck lot or a new car lot, would happen to be trucks, not truck lots, but if you ever see a new truck, you'll see these little round circles all along the front of the bumper. And those are sensors, and the sensors indicate if you're getting too close to an object, and they'll alert you in the cab that you're about to hit, like, say, a pole. Like you pull into a parking spot at a mall or Walmart or whatever, and you see these light poles. If you get too close to that, the little sensor in the front will actually ding and let you know you're too close. And every manufacturer does different things with it. Some manufacturers put a screen on the IP that says you're getting too close, and have different zones that you get too close to it. And so when you're like one bar pops up, you're close, and three bars pop up, and the lights start really going crazy if you got too close. I've seen other manufacturers, they have a green line that starts building, then it's like a sonar, and it turns like yellow and it turns red when you're close. So when you put those, when you have those things on your bumper, and then you put a big grille guard over it, I don't see a way around that. I mean, the sensors aren't going to see through the steel grille guard. So, anyways, I digress. Check out the story. I talked to the IIHS. I've talked to different manufacturers, and they all gave me their point of view, which says it could be some problem in the future with the grille guards. Also making news this week is another new technology, electric trucks. There's two electric truck manufacturers making news right now. The first one is called Workhorse W15. Let me pull up their information here. They are Workhorse Group Incorporated, W15. They are out of Ohio, I believe. Was I was reading? Yep. They'll be built in Union City, Ohio. The plan is to offer this electric truck. It's going to have offer a front and rear electric motor, so you'll have a four-wheel drive system. There's not a whole lot of more details about it besides it looks like it's going to have a generator. It's going to have a very small could have a very small plug-in engine to go with it. It's which is going to be a range extender. It's kind of like the i3's range extender. It's going to offer 75 miles of range on a fully charged battery. So they're calling electric, but it's doing an electric hybrid really, but it's going to be mostly electric. So it's going to have 75 miles of fully charged battery. Then after that, it'll have a very small turbocharged, small displacement engine to allow you to limp home, basically, is what the engine's going to allow you to do. They are saying that it's going to provide, it's going to be capable of towing 5,000 pounds and offer a payload rating of 2,200 pounds, which is basically a V6 engine these days. They've received a letter of interest from 1,000 people of, excuse me, let me say this differently. They've received a letter of interest for 1,000 versions of their truck. Letter of interest is from the Clean Fuels Ohio, Duke Energy, Portland General Electric, the City of Orlando, Florida, and Southern California Public Power Authority. Basically, they're going to use these as landscaper trucks, right? They're going to throw small loads in the back. They may tow some lawnmowers. They may tow, throw some weed whackers around in the back. If they want to go do some landscaping or You know, another thing the city does quite a bit is they take toilet paper. This is interesting. I learned this a few years ago. They will take toilet paper and cleaning supplies to different county buildings. And it's actually one of the things they use a lot of work vehicles for is transporting toilet paper and toiletries around different buildings. There was a place in Ohio, I believe, that they had parked their F-350s with the big snow plows and taken small electric trucks and drove them around the town and during this, to deliver said toilet paper. So again, there's another use for this. It's an expensive truck though. It has a, let me back up and say it's got a Mad Max look to it in the front. You have to check it out. I'll share this on our Facebook page on Pickup Truck Talk. The price on this is $52,500, what they're hoping their MSRP is going to be. The company has a factory capacity of 60,000 units. You know, this is all, nobody really knows anything. May 2nd, this truck is supposed to be revealed. And at that time, we'll know all the details. Another truck that they're working on to make it revealed, and they said later this summer, I think it's the summer they said it as well, is Bollinger. Bollinger? I believe I'm saying that right. Bollinger, it's a New York-based entrepreneur, Robert Bollinger. He plans on building a truck as well, and he wants an electric, all-electric powertrain. And he says that the truck will have unparalleled traction, torque, and ground clearance. All right, look, electric vehicles have amazing torque, and the reason for that is unlike a gasoline engine that's got to build up the inertia, that's got to build up the combustion, you know, that's got to fire up and build up the speed. Electric is on demand, done. You have the power right away. I was talking to another manufacturer a couple years ago, and they were actually burning tires, like not well burning them. Plus, they're ripping the tires in shreds off of the wheel wells because as soon as they hit the gas, they had instantaneous power. Well, the wheels were spinning so fast right away, the rubber was still stuck to the ground and didn't get a move, and so they actually ripped the rubber in half. So, I mean, that's the amount of electric power you have. And that's the benefit of EV. It's power on demand. It's like a golf cart. As soon as you get in a golf cart, you press the accelerator, and if it's an electric golf cart, you just take off. You take off at the full speed, at all power. I mean, yeah, it's got to build up a little bit to get the tires moving. You got to build some inertia up, but it's on demand right away. So they can talk about unparalleled torque because, well, they're going to get it. All they got to do is, what they really have to do with these electric vehicles is they have to turn down the electric power at the start because you'll rip the tires off. And so they make these systems in a way that they drive like a gasoline powered engine, but you have electric power. The traction is an interesting thing. I would think that that is probably a byproduct of the wheel choices they're using and the torque. And then the last thing will have ground clearance, which is kind of ridiculous. And I say that because electric vehicles, you know, the big detriment to them is going to be wind. Wind's going to slow them down and it's going to cause them to have some energy loss. And so if you look at some of the, you know, the electric vehicles out there, they've been built lower to the ground, a lot of aerodynamics. So that way you save your battery. You're not wasting your battery fighting the wind and going through it. It's one of the big detriments to trucks has been is if you put a big load in the bed and you raise it up and lift it and drive, you're not going to get the fuel economy. It's not, you know, that's physics. So I would think that you'd want less ground clearance. You would want more of a vehicle that would provide, be the landscaper vehicle, which is what EVs, trucks have historically been. But this company is saying that their plan is for ranchers and farmers to have an EV vehicle. I find that also fascinating for a couple different reasons. Firstly, I've never talked to a farmer who has $50,000 sitting around ready to buy an electric truck. And I've never talked to a rancher who wants to take his $50,000 electric truck and go out there and haul or push cattle around. I mean, these guys are old school guys. They want their big diesel engines. They want to tow a lot of stuff, and they don't want to worry about charging it up, you know. And another interesting thing that they're going to run into with EV power in a ranch and a farming situation is, excuse me, also is builders and off-roaders. I'm not buying that stuff either. The other problem with electric power that you run into is in colder climates, your battery storage changes with the what you plug it in. They don't hold as much range. I had the a year ago, I had the Chevy Volt, which is a hybrid electric gasoline engine, and I did some research on that, and they were discussing the wintertime range capacities. There's a group in Canada, which is a huge Chevy Volt fan club, and they were talking about the different range capacity and how it changes with the different seasons. And so you have the same thing happen there, and I'm not sure a rancher's going to go out to calving time and be driving around checking for calves and trying to get calves and working 14-hour days and be worried about plugging his truck in. I don't know. I'm not seeing that a whole lot. But it's good. I hope they bring it to marketplace. I'm excited to see new products. I think this is going to push the industry to really come up with some new ideas along electric power. And electric power, hey, it makes sense. I mean, I drove the Volt. I loved it because I didn't drive more than, I forget the range, maybe 50, 70, 65, whatever the mileage was. I didn't drive more than that in a day. And so I drove for 3.5 days without plugging it in. That was fantastic. I mean, if the ground clearance had been higher, which is funny, I mentioned that earlier. If the ground clearance was higher, we'd probably buy one for my wife because that's what she drives in a day. She drives about 50 miles. Well, in my neck of the woods, it snows. And when it snows, you're not getting over the got getting through the snow because they don't always plow it right away. And so I wanted the vehicle with more ground clearance. So maybe this is. Maybe this truck will be it. Maybe I can convince her to buy a truck that I get to drive whenever I want to. All right, that's enough for me. Up next, I want to talk about the Million Mile Tundra. I went to Alabama. I went to the Huntsville, Alabama, the Tamale Factory. I'm sorry, the Toyota Motor Manufacturing Assembly Plant in Alabama. No, TMMAL. Toyota does these acronyms. It's kind of interesting. And then was there, and then we flew to Michigan, and we went to the Toyota Technical Center in Saline, Michigan, and talked to their engineers about the Million Mile Tundra. Well, all that story, the fantastic story. Coming up next. Right, let's talk about the Million Mile Tundra. If you don't know this story, what happened was about a year ago, I wrote a story for Truck Trend Magazine that was about a Million Mile Tundra. A guy named Victor Shepard in Houma, I believe it's called Houma, Louisiana. My Yankee pronunciation is going to have to suffice. Sorry for our southern U.S. fans. I think it's Houma, Louisiana. He's a hotshot driver. So what he does is he basically delivers all the stuff that's too hazardous to mail. And he does a lot of work as well with oil fields and the oil operations. So he'll get a phone call to say, come to Montana and pick up this part, or and we need this for a drilling operation down in Nevada. And he'll drive up there, pick it up, take it down to Nevada, and it goes back and forth. Or he'll go do a lab in Washington, D.C., where they're doing chemical weapon, say they're doing the chemicals for that. He'll pick up that chemical and he'll drive it across country to, say, Seattle to get shipped out. So he does a lot of driving. He had a 2007 Toyota Tundra. It was a extended cab, and it was the 4.6 liter. Let me double check my stuff here, because it was a 2UZ engine, 2UZFE engine, excuse me. And I wanted to make sure I get the right displacement, 4.7 liter V8. The new one's a 4.6. That was the deal. So it's a 2UZFE engine. It was built at the Huntsville, Alabama engine plant. This plant is really cool. I flew out to do the story. So this is the third part of the story. You'll find it on Truck Trend Magazine. It'll also be in the magazine, print magazine later on this year. Toyota flew me to Alabama and also to Michigan to the third part, and thankfully they did, because without their assistance it's really hard to do this story. And so I went down to Alabama with Brian Watkins. Brian Watkins doesn't get mentioned for anything. He's a fantastic Toyota employee. He does all the behind the scenes video and photography and stuff. You see a poster of like a Toyota vehicle, or you see press releases with Toyota vehicles and manufacturer video shots. He might have been the guy to take it. There's another guy as well, but he takes a lot of photos too. Does a lot of video. So he met me down there. We flew in, stayed the night in Alabama. Next morning, went to the Toyota Motor Manufacturing Alabama plant, Tamal, which was really interesting. It's a engine plant. They build a 4-cylinder, a V6, and a V8. They don't build this V8 anymore. They build a new V8, and they build the 5.7 liter V8 as well. You know what? I want to double check that stuff. They're really proud to say that they are the only manufacturing plant that builds V8 engines for Toyota that's not in Japan. And I think that's pretty remarkable because if you remember, if you're a fan of manufacturing, you may recall that for years there's been this thinking that Americans can't build the same quality that the Japanese can. And so this plan has proven wrong. And it's exciting, right? It's a million-mile vehicle, and the engine powered it. And this million-mile vehicle, a Shepherd's Beast, we call it the Beast, the easier way to say it, the 2007, it had the same engine and transmission that it did throughout its life. He never replaced that. So you have an engine that's made a million miles on it. I mean, how many hours that turns into be, I don't know how many hours that is, but that's a lot of wear and tear. And so the Huntsville team was really excited to see it. They actually were trying to figure out who was on the line, when was it built. They have a serial number, they can match it all down to figure out what time frame it was. It's a very exciting time for them and good for them. I mean, they just built their 5 millionth engine the week before we got there. I think it was a Friday before. And so they've came from a manufacturing facility that only built a 4.7-liter V8. That was the only thing they built back then. Or the 4.7-liter V8, the Beast engine, the 2UZ. That was the only thing they built. And now they're building two different V8s. They're building the 5.7-liter V8, excuse me, and the V6 and the four-cylinder. And so they have this whole variety of engines they're running now, and they've really proven themselves in quality. And this million-mile Tundra is the benchmark. It is the quality leader. And what's fascinating about this was we sat around this round table and we're talking with them. I was talking with various engineers and different people that were there at the time. And I was startled by something, and I want to play you the audio because I went and got the audio for this, and I want you to hear it firsthand so you can really hear the excitement I had and the wow factor.
When you were tearing it down, when you're thinking about tearing it down, did you have any thoughts about specific areas you're looking at? Like cylinder walls, like the piston rings, the bearings, yeah.
What? As a whole, when we started building, tearing it down, you know, in our mind, you know, just looking on the outside looking in, you know, because at first we ran a performance test on it, and that's what we do in our dyno cells. And that test ran very well. So that was kind of exciting then just to see the numbers, and the numbers actually superseded original engine that was we used to test offline.
Oh, wait a minute. You put this engine on the dyno and it ran better than the engine came off the line?
Pretty much. We got good numbers. So
after a million miles, it ran better. All right.
Yes, it ran good. So in my mind, as I began to tear it down, I was kind of excited about the external part. So, okay, this thing ran that good. So how is it going to look inside? So, and as we were tearing it down, you know, it was kind of exciting because Shane and I, we shared that time. And as we were going, we just looked at the condition and it was unbelievable. And you know, it looks better than a lot of dyno engines that we tested.
You know, one thing you've got to understand too, now when the engine was new, it's what you call it was not broke in yet. You
Right,
know, so
right.
once it's ran some, it actually breaks the rings and stuff in better. That's part of why you've seen better numbers.
Yes, really, really, truly, they put it on a dyno and they tested it out. Which was fascinating. There was a lot of debate about that. They told me that there was a lot of concerns. You know, when Toyota bought the truck, they let it sit for a few months. They showed it off. They shipped it around. Nobody knows if it had been fired up. Nobody knows, you know, that really had driven it. So they wanted to make sure that when they fired it up, it was in good working order. And so, you know, now it turns out that the engine had been driven and the truck had been driven before it got sent to Alabama. But these guys didn't know that. They just thought it was shipped around. And so when they threw it in the dyno, they had some problems because they don't build an engine anymore. And so they had to modify some parts and make some parts, and they had to hook it up, and then they got it running. And then it ran, and they pushed up to 5,700 RPMs, and it ran like a champ. And so then they took it off, and they tore it down. And so I got to go behind the scenes at the facility. They have a work area in the middle of the factory, and it's where they have a teardown lab. And basically, they have these stands and they tear down engines all the time, and they test these quality engines, and they make sure that they're, you know, every once in a while they pull an engine off the line, tear it down and spec it and check specifications to make sure it's going to be a good engine, and just as part of the quality control process. And so they did that with this engine, and it was literally like getting a behind the scenes view, if you will, maybe like a museum type view of an artifact. Like, but instead of being behind glass, not being able to see it, I was able to walk up and actually touch it. and I hold it up and actually look at it and flip it around and look in the cylinder walls, look for the cross hatching, look at the bottom of the valve stems. And what's remarkable about this truck, what's really remarkable about it, is how unremarkable the pieces came out to be. Like, there's nothing wrong with this engine. It, on their quality scores, it was scored a 99 out of 100, right? They spec'd it all out. The spec of the pistons and things, they didn't match up to what spec would have been brand new, but it's not going to. But they're still within the operating range. They literally could have taken this engine, put it back in the line, and shipped it off in a truck. That's how good it was. And they really, when I looked at the various pieces, so the block, the cylinder head, the cylinders still had cross hatching. The valve stems had a little bit of carbon buildup. The crankshaft, the journals on the crankshaft were some of the cleanest I've seen. And on the bearings, they had one spot on one bearing that had one little mark on it. The rest of them were perfect. So, I mean, you're talking a million miles, you're talking off-road, under load, and yet this engine still looked that remarkable. With this part of the trip done, we flew to Michigan to check out the... After Alabama, we flew to Michigan to visit the Toyota Motor North America Research and Development Headquarters in Saline, Michigan. Now, this is where they do all the designing of the new trucks. This is where they do design new trucks and cars and SUVs, everything Toyota builds in North America. They want to do some design work, engineering work, that they do it in this facility. It's kind of cool. They're going through an expansion, and so they have a lot of construction going on, and it's kind of fun to watch new construction happen and how the building's changing. As one of the guys said to me, he says, you know, literally it's old Toyota versus new Toyota. The old side of the building is very plain Jane, cookie cutter, nothing exciting, you know, everything is very minimalistic. And the new side of Toyota is a lot more fantastic, a lot, you know, just miles of fantastic better. It's more interesting to see. It's got nicer chairs. It's got more individual offices, you know, it's got a lot more meeting rooms. It's going to be a very interesting, it kind of shows you the difference between North America and how far they've come. And it's going to be a really great facility when they're done. And so I went into their lab there at the Toyota Technical Center, and it's a very interesting lab, and they do everything that I would expect other OEMs to do. They take new cars of competitors and they tear them all down, and they look at all the different parts, and they literally can examine everything, and then they catalog it all, and they make decisions on future products and where they think, you know, they should add and improve their product versus where the competitors should do their product. And so this really nice lab setup. And while we're in there, I met with several engineers, and we were talking about the Tundra, and they had done a teardown as well, like the Alabama facility did, and they had taken the body off the frame. And they had separated parts, and they had taken the pieces, and they labeled them all. And so there are several key pieces I'm going to look at. So if you recall from earlier, I said that Shepard drove around a lot, and he did oil rigs in different places. So he had quite a bit of loads, and so he would do a lot of pallet loads. And he had in the truck at any given time payloads upwards of 1,500 to 2,700 pounds. Sorry, I had that number written down somewhere. 1,500 to 2,700 pounds in the bed, numerous ranges. Now, that is beyond the truck's capability, especially because he's not a slender guy. But the truck handled it without any problems. I would have guessed that at certain times it was a little bit overloaded. The springs, though, this is the thing. So he loaded it all the time, and he put stuff in the bed. And so the bed's got lots of wear and tear, but nothing poked through, nothing really rusted besides a few spots where the paint had gotten dinged off. The bed was still in pretty good shape. It's one of those weird things where you can put a bed liner in it and sold it as a new, as used bed. I mean, it would have been fine. The interesting part when I'm getting to was the leaf springs. So the leaf springs never been changed. And so if you look at the leaf springs, they still look like they were in decent shape. So, you know, they had some gaps, they had some wear there. It wasn't as tight as the brand new ones were, but you could still do some more loads with them. They still had more left in to give. The frame was in really good shape. You know, interestingly enough, If you know Toyota products, you know that they have a long history of some rust issues with some frames. They had some lawsuits they settled. Some things had happened. You know, people complained about rusting frames. What's surprising with this truck is even though it was, he lived in Louisiana, was housed in Louisiana, he did a lot of driving through the Rust Belt. He did a lot of driving in the Rust Belt during the wintertime, too, because he was always on the road. So it's surprising that there wasn't any rust at all on it, which either comes back to how good of care he took with the truck, or that maybe the rust issues are gone. I mean, this maybe proves it. Another area of interest that I looked at very, very closely was the seat. So as I said, Victor Shepard, by no stretch of the imagination, was a skinny guy. Or a slender, or a small guy. He was a good-sized man. Defensive lineman size. I mean, this is the size the guy was. He wasn't obese. He wasn't fat to me. He just was, that's his frame. He was a big guy. And the seat. The seat was one of the most critical pieces that we wanted to look at because he would sit in this truck for hours, right, driving all these miles. But if he got tired, he'd pull over and sleep in the truck. He told me several times that instead of hotel rooms, he just pulled over and reclined the seat and took a nap. And then he'd get back on the road and keep driving. So, I mean, this seat had a lot of heavy duty, let's say, to keep up and to keep up with his needs on it. And this, incredibly, the seat was in really good shape. It really was fascinating to see it. I happened to redo my 62 Chevy seat a while back, and I kind of have an idea now on the background of the seats and how they kind of work together. And examining all the pieces of the seat in the back and the bottom of the cushion and how it all worked, it was still in great shape, which is really surprising. It still met their expectations after all the time they had spent in it. And then looking at, he had cloth interior, and so they had the seat cloth material next to the seat for us to, for me to examine. And it had one small rip. And I bet you Victor never even noticed it because it's kind of where the sides of the seat kind of came together. The seat bolsters would come in a little bit. And he may not even noticed it because it was just maybe in the seam there not to see it. It had a small rip, maybe the length of a quarter. And when you looked at it, it looked like it was pretty good rip, like a knife or something had gone into it, but it didn't cut through the back of the seat, the back of the seat cushion, and so it's just a superficial cut. That was it. After all those miles, that was it, which was just phenomenal that that's what that truck held up to be. Looked in the cab, and they had torn down everything, all the interior pieces off, and taken all the foam deadeners off and things like that, and looked like a brand new cab. I mean, no spots of dings, no spots of rust. Heck, the carpet looked good as well. I mean, you know, you'd expect the carpet to be beat up after all those miles. No, carpet looked fine too. You know, I'm sure he had the floor mats in it, but still, even after wearing through floor mats, it still looked like it was a good carpet. Again, this truck, even though it has a million miles on it, actually it was 1,020,000 miles on it, it still looked like a truck that had maybe 100,000 miles on it. Now, after examining everything and getting a look at how all the parts, you know, came out, including shipping stuff too, including the center console still closed. The tailgate still closed. these are incredible things, folks. One of the riding handling engineers actually walked up, and I have him on audio. I'm going to play that next. Now, this is very interesting because the ride handling engineer I talked to was with the original truck. So he had driven the original truck in production, and now he drove the Million Mile Tundra, and he was able to give me some impressions on how the two trucks drove.
So talk to us about ride and handling. So you did the previous gen, or you did this gen.
That's right.
And then you drove this gen, or drove this vehicle.
Yes.
So what are you thinking? What did you find?
Yeah, it held up extremely well. I mean, the performance at the end was amazingly close to
really.
Yeah, really.
No,
was.
Wasn't any changes in handling? Wasn't anything that Right.
So Kevin may have touched on it. You know, we drive after we do like a mileage accumulation thing. We drive those trucks so you get a sense of how they perform after they've gone through what would be considered a normal life cycle, I guess, you know. And then this vehicle really is amazing to see how close it was to like just your normal mileage accumulation vehicle to represent the customer thing. So that was very impressive, you know, to see how well it still held up.
Did anything stand out to you that's opportunity or?
I think a lot of people maybe, you know, when you look at just how does a vehicle drive and is it doing anything unusual and just the overall operation of the vehicle, overall drivability, like I said, was very, very similar to what you'd expect of just a kind of normal customer mileage accumulation. So at that level of mileage, it was really impressive to see that.
When you first saw it and got in, did you think it was a million mile truck?
No.
Right. It stands out to you. It stood out to me as being, this could be 100,000 miles. Yeah, it could
be.
I've seen trucks with 150,000 miles that look worse.
I believe you. Check the odometer to make sure.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it really is.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Huh. So and that's impressive that it was that close to what you had found before.
Right.
Even with all the driving he did and all the variety. I think that's the biggest story is all the variety of driving. Like, he did dirt driving. He did it wasn't severe off-road, but it wasn't on just the highway going back and forth. I mean, he did city, did highway, did all sorts of stuff. My expectation would be something would jimmy free, right? Somebody would be a little wonky in the axles and things.
And with high load, too.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's you're right. It's the entire cycle of everything you've driven.
Just incredible to me that truck with that many miles can still drive so well. And it's really a testament to having all of your maintenance work done. It's a testament to Toyota's build quality. It's to Toyota's suppliers, to Toyota's engineering. I mean, it's the whole works, you know. Shepard had his truck serviced whenever it came up for service intervals. He kept up with his maintenance. And, you know, incredibly, when he got rid of the truck, it was still worth $7,000 through Kelley Blue Book, which is pretty incredible. And it's also pretty incredible Kelley Blue Book has a statistic for a million miles. They allow you to put that in. So a great story. You'll see, like I said, I'll share more of it on our Facebook page. Just check us out on pickuptrucktalk.com. And I'll have all the stories on there as well, including some background information. So up next, let's talk about the Jeep Wrangler Rubicon Hard Rock I've been driving this week, and we'll be right back with that after this break. And finally on today's show, let's talk about the 2017 Jeep Wrangler Rubicon. This is a two-door hardtop. It's got the 3.6-liter V6 and a 5-speed automatic transmission. It has this really crazy color to it. I'm trying to find the exact word for it, if they even say what the color is on this. Oh, here it is. Hyper green clear coat exterior paint. Think a highlighter green. That's how I kind of describe it. It is wild. I went up to Wyoming and did some goose hunting with it and hit some puddles and got some mud on it, as I should. It's a Jeep, but Jeeps look better muddy, right? And it's remarkable how the contrast between the mud on the side of it and the hyper-tech green or hyper-green color looks. It looks kind of out of place. I should go wash it. I thought about that several times, taking it down to get washed. It's a Rubicon edition, so it's got all your four-wheel drive, your front locker, your rear locker, the Dana 44 heavy-duty front and rear axles, rear stabilized bars. It's got these rock rails. The rock rails are interesting. So they're bars that go right outside the door, and they're not step-down bars. They're rock rails. They're meant to keep rocks from dinging into the side of the cab. But at my height, sometimes I use them, sometimes I don't. It's this whole awkward thing that comes up every time I get in and out of this thing. And it's your typical Jeep, so inside it's very square and very boxy and very, I used to be in the military Jeep-ish. What's kind of interesting that I didn't realize until I was driving it around, and I don't know why it hit me, was that the speedometer's on the left side and the tachometer's on the right, and I've driven a lot of vehicles, and I can't remember that many vehicles having the speedometer left and the tachometer right. Seems like it's the other way around. I noticed it because I usually, the way I drive, my hand position on the steering wheel was messed up. I couldn't see the speed I was going. I had to switch hands, so I had to drive right-handed instead of left-handed, and just kind of move things around so I could see how fast I was going. It just was just weird and awkward. We did get some groceries with it, and the rear seats do fold up. You do have some cargo room. I couldn't fit my shotgun back there. It doesn't fit lengthwise. Doesn't fit. It does kind of fit lengthwise as long as I stand it up on the side and kind of line along the side there. So there's not a great amount of room. Surprising, though, is we put the seats forward, and the whole bench seats in the rear actually fold forward, but there's not a latch to lock them down. We actually almost lost some eggs. It was kind of a big bump that I may have inadvertently driven over a puddle of mud when we had some groceries. All right, so anyways, the speaker system audio works all right. I think it's a great system. It's an Alpine system. I think the problem is the Jeep. It's going to echoey. It's got the metal top because you can take the roof off and you can take the sides off. It's got the Freedom top, which is their three-piece hard top, which I would have loved to have done, but this entire week there's been 50-mile-an-hour winds, and driving around the top on 50-mile-an-hour winds was not my idea of a fun time. It does have the 410 rear axle, so it's got plenty of power when things get stuck and get in your way out of Dodge. I thought it was interesting. I've driven the same model with the, I believe it's a 6-speed manual, maybe a 5-speed, maybe one of the two. And I drove it to Cheyenne, which I'm actually going to do with this vehicle tomorrow. I drove it to Cheyenne, and I had a heck of a time getting the right gearing to work with a manual transmission at higher speeds and the incline. So going to gearing is about 3,000-foot climb over, I-80. It's a gradual climb, and it's at 75, 80 miles per hour. And that transmission, I just could not get it to stay in a gear I liked. I'd get the sixth gear, and it would just kind of roll back on me, and I'd get in the fifth gear and have to put a lot more gas into it or slow off the gas to, because the RPMs were flying too high. So I'm excited to see how this automatic transmission works. If it's anything like I've been driving around lately, it's the way to go. I didn't have to have nearly the amount of trouble that I was having with the manual, which I know there are those Jeep fans that'll take me to the woodshed and knock me around a little bit because they feel like the automatic is the way to go. But I got to tell you, for highway speeds, between here and Wyoming, it's about 70 miles an hour. It's kind of recommended. 75 kind of works out. And I got to tell you, the 5-speed was a much more enjoyable drive with the automatic than it had been with the transmission or the manual I had been last year. So something to really keep in mind is, yes, the manual is better. The manual is better off-roading because you have more control over the gearing. You can stay it in low gears and keep the torque up. But, the automatic has the shifter on it, so you can actually manually do the gearing with the automatic. It's got the shifter comes over and you can select the gears. So maybe you're not getting as much as you thought you were getting. I don't know. Typical Jeep, though, and fuel economy was terrible. Well, all right. So the size of vehicle, you'd want to have better fuel economy. 18 combined, 17 city, 21 highway. It's got a small tank, too. I want to say it's a 12-gallon tank. I haven't driven it that much, and I'm already less than half tank, so maybe I have driven it that much. But it seemed like I was going through gas rather quickly. I'm sure I'm going to have to get more gas before I go to Cheyenne tomorrow. You come down to the problem that this one runs into. Not a problem is that you have to know you're buying a Rubicon. And if you're going to buy a Rubicon and get all the off-road capability, you're going to pay for it. So the base price is $33,645 for the base Jeep. You add the Rubicon package, which is $4,800. You add the automatic transmission, $1,400. The rear axle, 410 rear axle, $695. The Freedom Top, the three-piece hard top, is $595. The radio upgrade, it's got an upgraded radio with a 40-gigabyte hard drive and 28-gigabyte available hard drive. I didn't realize it had hard drive space to it. That's kind of a cool thing. I kind of just plugged my phone with it. So anyways, you add that in, and that's $1,195. You have a destination charge of $995. What do we add up to? $43,325 pennies is what will get you the truck, or the SUV. I don't know. If you're doing a lot of off-roading, I can see you doing it. I can see if you did it if you live with you and another spouse or you and your buddies or something like that. Kids is another deal. My neighbor's actually has this same Jeep, and he's got a couple kids, and he was telling me he's looking for a new vehicle because getting in and out of the the back row, getting out of the second row with the kids is becoming an issue. The kids have, what did the kids do? They've grown. Yes, they've grown. They've gotten larger. And so you can't get out of the back seats as well as they used to. So he's a market for a new one. I can see why you buy this too. I can see why it'd be a lot of fun. If I lived by myself without having the kids, I'd drive it. I will tell you that I've been putting the kids in the front seat because I'm not going to have them climb in the back seat. I'm not doing the seatbelts back there. I'm just not doing it. So maybe I'm breaking the law a little bit, but that's all right because I'm only driving about a half mile to get them from daycare. Anyways, you can find a local Jeep dealer. It is right there, right there now. It's on the dealer lots. An idea to keep in mind on, though, is keep an eye on the news. The new Jeep Wrangler is coming out pretty soon. They've been a lot of talk about it. They're talking about delayed, now they're talking about bringing it back. So keep an eye out for that. There's a lot of conservative conversations about what it's going to be. There's a lot of wild guesses about aluminum, about changing the axles. I think it's going to stay the same. I think it's going to probably get a turbocharged engine in it to get some fuel economy out of it. I can see, again, some high-strength steel instead of aluminum just for the beating it would take. But I don't know. There's a lot of talk going on with the Jeep Wrangler. And so this is maybe a model you want to look at closely. If you've ever wanted a Jeep Wrangler, you know, maybe this is the style you want to check because the next style may not be what you want. Well, that's it for today's show. Make sure you check us out on iTunes, Google Play, Facebook page, Pickup Truck Talk. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at testerdahl or tim.estradahl. Send me an email at tim@pickuptrucktalk.com. Check out the website at pickuptrucktalk.com. And we'll see you down the road.